From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The world has passed 30 million confirmed coronavirus cases. More than a fifth of those cases have been recorded in the United States, where we're nearing 200,000 confirmed COVID-19 deaths. For more, Lena Wen joins us, an emergency physician and public health professor at George Washington University. Dr. Wen, we're seeing the nation's COVID cases tick up again. What is driving the increase this time?
It's a convergence of many factors. We reopened initially after Memorial Day too soon against a backdrop of surging infections. And so we are already at a high level of infections while restrictions continue to be removed. And then we have universities coming back, K-12 institutions coming back. I mean, I understand, of course, why we would want to bring these institutions back, and our students need in-person instruction. We need for our economy to reopen. But we also have to recognize that we have a very contagious virus among us. And as soon as we dial back these restrictions, we are going to see these surges. And so it's a question of what happens from here coming into winter months when it's going to be harder to be outdoors. We could be having the convergence then of the flu and other respiratory pathogens in the winter. And I really worry about our inadequate capabilities, in particular when it comes to testing.
Yeah, we have no coherent national testing system. The New York Times is reporting that last month when the CDC published new testing guidelines that said not to test anyone who was asymptomatic, they did so over the strong objections of scientists within the agency. What is the cost at this point of not testing asymptomatic people?
Well, when those guidelines came out from the CDC, I think so many of us public health experts said, what is going on? I mean, it's not as if new research was done. And it just does not make any sense that we should not be testing asymptomatic individuals. Actually, the spread is driven by asymptomatic individuals. If you're symptomatic, you shouldn't be going out and interacting with others. The reason why the spread is occurring is because of asymptomatic people who don't know that they have the infection and thus are spreading it. And so the fact that these guidelines were changed, it's caused mass confusion. The CDC has always been the premier public health institution. They've upheld the highest standards of scientific rigor and integrity. And now the work of the excellent scientists there is being challenged and undermined. And I worry that this could have lasting damage. And really, the worst time that this could happen is in the middle of this global pandemic.
Well, and this is just another example of the politicization of this virus. Let's listen here to the two candidates for president. This is President Trump yesterday at a rally in Wisconsin.
You're not allowed to go to church. You're not allowed to meet. You're not allowed to talk to anybody. You have to stay in a prison. Your home has become your prison. And then I'm saying, well, what are you allowed to do? Sir, you're not allowed to do anything. I mean, there is one thing, but it doesn't pertain to you. What is it? Well, you are allowed to protest.
Oh, really?
Oh. Hence the name. We call them friendly protests.
Meanwhile, here is Joe Biden in a voter town hall last night.
If the president had done his job, from the beginning, all the people would still be alive. All the people, I'm not making this up, just look at the data. Look at the data.
Dr. Wen, what do you think when you hear those two clips?
Here's what I think. This is a public health catastrophe. It needs to be led by public health. Public health is based on science, and science should not be politicized. And when it is, and when there is scientific interference, it erodes trust in the key institutions that we need to get us out of this. It's a really big problem that somehow public health has been framed as the enemy. Public health is not the enemy of the economy. It's the roadmap to getting our economy back on track, our kids back in school. And it is a serious problem that we've had mixed messaging that's been not only hampering our response, but actively destructive towards it.
Just very briefly, people are starting to get their flu shots as we get into flu season. Is there any chance that we'll see a reduced toll from the flu this year because of the social distancing for COVID?
Absolutely. The same measures that are used to prevent COVID also will be effective in preventing the flu. So we could see a much milder flu season, but we may not. We may still be facing the twindemics of the flu and COVID-19, and we cannot pin all of our plans on a hope. So we hope for the best, but we have to prepare for the worst.
Dr. Lena Wen, a public health professor at George Washington University, thank you.
Thank you.
And by the way, this just in, the CDC has reversed its guidance on COVID testing and now says anyone who's been in close contact with someone who is infected needs to get a test.
Controversial changes to the Postal Service have been put on hold after a judge yesterday ruled in favor of 14 states suing the Trump administration. The federal judge in Washington state said President Trump and Postmaster General Louis DeJoy were engaged in a, quote, politically motivated attack on the efficiency of the Postal Service and ordered them to halt changes DeJoy proposed back in July. Michigan was one of the states suing the administration, and we're joined now by Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, who's also a Democrat. And Secretary, how do you think this is going to impact the election, and what's your reaction to this ruling?
Well, I think the ruling was and the injunction was incredibly gratifying for those of us who have seen firsthand the impact of many of these changes that happened without our knowledge, without our input, and had a result impact of slowing down the process and really moving us backwards away from a lot of the agreements and collaborations we developed at the local level with our postal service leaders. And of course, it also created a lot of confusion for our voters, many of whom are voting by mail for the first time. So I'm hopeful this ruling will help us provide clarity that voting by mail is safe, secure, and we'll be able to put procedures in place to ensure every vote is counted.
I want to ask you about something else. So hundreds of Michigan voters serving in the military or living overseas received ballots without Vice President Mike Pence's name on them. They labeled a Libertarian candidate as President Trump's running mate. How does something like this happen? And do mistakes like this worry you?
Well, to walk it back a bit, we actually don't know the number. It looks like it may just be a few individuals who actually received the ballot ultimately because it was sent to clerks and through a programming error, there was a deletion of a row that led to the bumping up of a candidate into a different column. Now, we caught that in 90 minutes. We corrected it. And we did follow up with all of the clerks who received the error and provided them with the information they would need to follow up with any voters and give them the correct ballots. So we've got procedures in place essentially to catch programming errors and computer glitches like this one. And we've been very transparent about it and exactly what we're doing to ensure that every voter, particularly our military and overseas voters, but all voters have accurate ballots and can ensure their votes are accurately counted this fall.
You're calling on the state legislature to allow election officials to start processing ballots before Election Day. What kind of difference will that make in getting accurate results out as quickly as possible? And how are you making sure that those votes stay secure until after in-person voting concludes on Election Day?
Well, it is critical that we hold the security of our ballots and the accuracy of our results as paramount. And that's exactly why we've been working with our legislative leaders to give our clerks more time to, on Monday or in the days leading up to the election, begin opening envelopes and preparing ballots sent through the mail to be counted. Right now, the counting can't start until Election Day, and that will require us to go far into the following day and maybe even the day after that to process and count more ballots than ever before.
Yeah, you're actually telling people don't expect results until maybe Thursday or Friday after the election.
Right, and that's just basic math. We've purchased new high-speed tabulators to count ballots, but we have hired more individuals. We've, in fact, recruited close to 20,000 new election workers this year to work in precincts and in absentee counting boards throughout the state. We expect to have the final unofficial results on the Friday after the election, and we're certainly going to work every minute from the moment those polls close to the moment that we have those final results to announce and ensure the public has accurate results of the election as quickly and as soon as possible.
Back in 2016, tens of thousands of ballots there in Michigan were tallied as having not listed any vote for president, which led people to suspect that the voting machines had misread them. I mean, President Trump only won the state by about 10,000 votes, and this potential undercount of votes prompted calls for a recount. What are you doing this time around to make certain that every vote is counted correctly and that everyone trusts the election results?
Well, it's so important, especially at a time when there are historic efforts to undermine voters' confidence in our elections. And it's one of the reasons why I created our state's first election security task force upon taking office. They recommended a number of implementations that we have implemented over the past year, including hiring a full-time election security director and implementing risk-limiting audits statewide, which will be auditing the results of our elections after the fact to ensure that the machines are accurately counting our ballots. So it's been an important priority of our administration that's now, you know, hit and run up against the challenges of operating elections during the pandemic, which has increased the number of citizens who want to vote by mail. It has increased the amount of rhetoric flowing into our state about and trying to, you know, again, sow confusion about that process and amplify our need to add another component of our election security work, which is protecting voters from misinformation. And that's something that we will be focusing on in particular in the weeks ahead.
That's Jocelyn Benson, a Democrat. She's also the Secretary of State for Michigan. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
A new documentary on Netflix called The Social Dilemma lays out the argument of how social media and smartphones are fundamentally altering human behavior. The film not only asks us to reevaluate our relationship with technology, it also argues that social media is eroding democracy.
We all simply are operating on a different set of facts. When that happens at scale, you're no longer able to reckon with or even consume information that contradicts with that worldview that you've created. That means we aren't actually being objective, constructive individuals.
Jeff Orlowski is the film's director. And Jeff, our listeners might actually be familiar with your environmental films, Chasing Ice and Chasing Coral. Why did you want to make a film about tech companies?
Yeah, it's funny. I kind of joke that we just work in existential crises. And, yeah. You know, we worked on climate change because it's a huge, huge existential crisis. And a couple of years ago, I started to learn about our technology and what these platforms are doing to society. One of our subjects describes this as a climate change of culture. It is invisibly shifting us through the code and the information that we engage with every day. And these platforms are changing our society and our civilization under our noses. I just got a sense of the scale of this and realized this is like the issue. This is an issue underlying all other issues. It almost doesn't matter what you care about. This is a foundational bedrock that shapes the world perceptions around fill-in-the-blank issue.
You made this very clear in your documentary, and most of the voices we hear from are former employees of the tech giants. Were you surprised by how many people wanted to speak out against the impacts of this technology they helped build?
It was incredibly difficult to get people to want to speak out on the record. We kept reaching out to lots of different people that we could find, or really the focus coming from former employees was one of our main objectives, because when I learned from the engineers that this is how we designed the code, or from the executives around this is why we built the business model in this particular way, they just carried so much credibility and validation for understanding what they were trying to say. I think we're also seeing more and more people within the industry starting to speak out and feeling more comfortable to speak out as the consequences continue to pile up.
One of those folks that you spoke with is Tristan Harris, the former design ethicist at Google. He's a central character in this documentary, and he says social media is more than just a tool for people to use. Let's listen.
It's seducing you. It's manipulating you. It wants things from you. And we've moved away from having a tools-based technology environment to an addiction and manipulation-based technology environment. That's what's changed. Social media isn't a tool that's just waiting to be used. It has its own goals, and it has its own means of pursuing them by using your psychology against you.
You know, Jeff, we learned a lot about the business models of these social media companies specifically a few years ago, but what is it that this technology wants from us, as Tristan puts it?
Yeah, well, it really comes down to what the incentives for the business model are. You know, the end result, the goal of the whole system in some ways, if you're continuing to build better and better tools for advertisers, which is how they've made so much money. So the end goal is really to identify an audience of one. They want to be able to pinpoint you exactly and to be able to have so much data about you that we know what makes you tick and we know what we can show you. It's bringing you into the system and it's figuring out all these ways to collect this data about you that puts each and every one of us in our own rabbit hole, our own filter bubble. One of our subjects says, you know, we have 2.7 billion Truman shows operating simultaneously. And I think that's really where this whole issue has given me the most cause for concern, that we've moved away from a shared sense of reality. And now we all have our own individual reality with our own individual facts, with our own individual stories that we see on a daily basis.
You also address the impact of social media on young people. I think someone in the documentary said there's now new generations of people who don't even know a world without social media. But you highlight rising rates of self-harm and suicide among teenagers. And one of your interview subjects, Jaron Lanier, speaks about this. Let's listen.
So we've created an entire global generation of people who were raised within a context with the very meaning of communication, the very meaning of culture is manipulation. We've put deceit and sneakiness at the absolute center of everything we do.
That is such a powerful statement.
It scares me quite a bit. I mean, I'm 36 years old, so I was born in an era before cell phones. To see how teenagers are growing up today and the way that these social platforms that are designed not by child psychologists, but designed by for-profit corporations, it's having these impacts that we're only going to see the full consequences of years down the line. The way we relate to each other, the way we connect with each other, and then all these consequences like rising rates of self-harm and suicide, in particular amongst young girls.
If we don't make these changes now, we're going to have an entire generation of humans that are being fundamentally shaped by this technology in ways that we can't predict what the outcomes will be.
And one thing, though, that quite a few people said is that it was not the intention of tech companies, specifically Facebook, to start off this when they started off. They had no idea that it would end up in this space. But the point is that doesn't matter what the original intention was.
Right. And I just want to reiterate that because absolutely, this was not the intention when these were set out. You know, Twitter was intended to be an art project when it first began. And so I can't fault anybody for what the intentions were or what led us down this path. But we are now at a stage where we recognize what the harms are and what the consequences are. I draw the analogy to the fossil fuel industry, where, you know, when we first started extracting fossil fuels from the ground, we just thought it was a really amazing resource that was just bringing great positivity to humanity. And it was only years later that we discovered, wait a second, maybe we have some consequences of this and we have to rethink it. And with that same analogy, like there was a fork in the road around the industry could have either changed and addressed it, but instead they hid it, they obfuscated it. And I think that's where we are right now with our social media technology. And I think the question really now is the industry going to change from the inside? Are they going to do the right thing? Are they going to step up and make the changes that are in society's best interest? Or are they going to stick to the status quo and just let the financial desires run the show here and wreak unknown consequences on humanity?
And the takeaway has been, we can hope that these private companies will take steps, but regulation seems to be something that many of the subjects you talk to brought up as a way to curb this.
Right. I really do think we have one of two options. Either they change on their own or they're forced to change. Those are the only two paths forward. And ultimately, from my perspective, that means they have to move off of this business model, that they have to serve society's interests first, that they've gotten so big, they've become these public utilities, basically. And if they're going to serve these roles, they need to serve it for society's purposes and not serve another master. They can't serve the advertising model and be funded that way and still garner the trust of the public.
We're heading into an election in which U.S. political campaigns and foreign actors are once again using social media to advance their messages and in very concrete ways, so general chaos. Mm-hmm. After making this film, what's your biggest fear about the U.S. election season?
Oh my goodness. I am nervous. I think the political misinformation, and there are so many different types of misinformation, and most fake news isn't fake and it isn't news. It's just taking things out of context slightly. I am concerned about the breakdown of truth. I'm really, really concerned about the fact that it seems harder and harder to have conversations with people that you disagree with. And if we can't agree on what's true, how do we have a functioning society? How do we address our problems? My concern is that we're just going to continue to go down this path where people can't engage with somebody that they disagree with, and it only gets worse and worse, and it leads to a breakdown in our society.
One of your subjects said he's afraid for a civil war.
Yeah. One of our subjects, Tim Kendall, uses that phrase explicitly. And when he first said that to me, I was like, are you serious? And after kind of living with that mindset and thinking through it and sitting with it in the edit, I mean, I really hope it doesn't put us down that path, but I easily could see how this could put us down that path. We have a machine whose main currency is outrage and anger. And if this is the trajectory that we're being programmed down, if we are constantly being fed the things that made us outraged and angry, and that is our life experience, and that's what we see on a daily basis, how does it not end in that sort of result? I really hope it doesn't go down that path, but I think that's where we need to change things now, create new technology that brings people together. Like, I want to have social media that can use all this data and profiling and identify who I am and help me find somebody who, it knows I'm going to be really good friends with this person, but we disagree on this issue. Mm-hmm. And I can have deep, meaningful conversations about this issue, but I'm still going to respect them as a person because it knows like we're going to be really good friends. I'm just spitballing an example here, but social media could really be designed in society's best interest. Right now, it's designed around commercial interests. These are tools designed by and for capitalism for financial profit for themselves and for the organizations in it. This is the biggest issue of our time. It is the way our information is being distributed, and it's a way that has broken down a shared sense of reality. And our hope is that this film can be a wake-up call and kind of shock people back into, getting us out of this, decade-long hypnosis that we've been in.
That's Jeff Orlowski, director of the film The Social Dilemma, which is now streaming on Netflix. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much.
U.S. downloads of the Chinese-owned social media app TikTok and WeChat will be blocked starting on Sunday. That's according to the Trump administration. More than 100 million people in the U.S. use these apps, which are owned by two separate Chinese tech companies. The announcement calls into question whether Trump will approve a deal announced this week between U.S. cloud computing company Oracle and TikTok. White House officials said parties have until November 12th to finalize a deal or the administration will fully ban TikTok. And for more, we're joined by MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi. Hey, Ali.
Hey, Tanya.
So what exactly does the ban mean for U.S. tech companies and consumers?
Well, so this is a tricky and complicated story. The Commerce Department basically is going to stop the Apple App Store and Google Play from offering both TikTok and WeChat from being downloaded in the United States. Now, American companies can keep doing business with both of those apps outside of the United States, and companies like Walmart and Starbucks, they use WeChat as a payment program for consumers outside of the U.S., particularly in China. Now, WeChat's going to be shut down starting on Sunday. TikTok, as you said, November 12th. And then even hosting them on the internet is going to be prohibited. Now, right now, TikTok's got some kind of a deal going with Oracle, in which could get around some of this stuff, and the ban might be lifted. But in the meantime, users of these apps are going to lose access to upgrades. They're going to lose access to maintenance. Of course, like in any country, if you use a virtual private network, you can sort of get around this. But fundamentally, doing business on these apps in the United States is going to become illegal until something changes.
Remind us, Ali, the Commerce Department said the ban is enforcing Trump's original executive orders that would block TikTok and WeChat for national security reasons. What does the Trump administration see as a threat?
Well, so WeChat and TikTok use users' locations and their messages, like a lot of platforms do, and they track things that people watch, what they click on, what they post, what they repost, and they target ads to them. But because these apps are under Chinese ownership, the White House says that they could be providing American user data to the Chinese government for intelligence and spying purposes. And that's not without basis, because in China, authorities do use these platforms to monitor political dissent and critics of the government. Some of those people have been detained by police or sentenced to prison for things that they've posted on platforms. So it's not clear, because the U.S. government has not applied the standard to all sorts of things. They seem to only be applying them to TikTok and WeChat, and the president doesn't really like TikTok for political reasons. But there is an underlying security concern that some people say does need to be addressed.
I mean, Trump has said that he must agree to any TikTok deal, and we know that there is this pending deal between Oracle and TikTok. It is unusual for a sitting president to be so involved in global business deals.
Wildly unusual, in fact. And part of the deal with Oracle is if they were to take over, they would host TikTok's user data and they'd review it to make sure that it was secure. But, you know, Trump, the government often reviews pending deals to protect consumers from, let's say, a monopoly or too many customers being controlled by one company. Sometimes there are actually national security concerns when a merger is announced. But this, Donald Trump's deep involvement in this particular deal is a big departure from how deals normally happen. In fact, he said that any company that acquires TikTok needs to make a payment to the U.S. Treasury as a sign of thanks.
Ali Velshi, as always, thank you.
Today, Alabama Governor Kay Ivey tours the state's coast where Hurricane Sally left widespread destruction earlier this week. The state is also home to one of the most closely watched Senate races in the country, and that's where we turn for this week's Here and Now Senate Tracker. The incumbent, Democratic Senator Doug Jones, is facing a challenge from Republican former college football coach Tommy Tuberville. Andrew Yeager is a reporter with WBHM in Birmingham and joins us now. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, and of course, in Alabama, people are still dealing right now with Sally, and I wonder whether that storm and the issue of climate change has come up in this race at all.
Climate change, not so much. It's a topic that Senator Doug Jones will talk about, and he has said that he believes climate change is real, that it's an issue that threatens our children and our grandchildren, and the U.S. should rejoin the accords in Paris around this issue. But I wouldn't say it's something that he's particularly forthright about, not a big issue. You know, Tommy Tuberville, he has expressed skepticism about the scientific consensus around climate change, saying that climate is something that God controls. And so you have a distinct difference between the two, but it's not something that's really driving the campaign in any meaningful way.
All right, well, let's talk about the candidates. Republican Tommy Tuberville, of course, beat out Jeff Sessions in the primary there, the former attorney general. This is a recent ad from Tuberville.
The way I was raised, before a football game, you stood to honor America. And after the game, you knelt to honor God. But today, those values are under attack. Socialism? Abortion on demand? Open borders? It's got to end. So I'm getting off the sidelines and into the fight.
Andrew, tell us more about Tuberville and what he's running on here.
Well, Tuberville is a former football coach at Auburn University here in Alabama. So he has a wide name recognition in the state, even though he hasn't coached in here for a while. And like you heard in the ad, he's mostly running on his conservative views, particularly on social issues, cultural issues. And, you know, he says he will back the president. He's tied himself very closely to Donald Trump. And that really, in a nutshell, was what his campaign is about.
And what about Senator Doug Jones? We remember that he, you know, just barely won that election a couple of years ago. He released this ad in June about the death of George Floyd at the hands of police. Listen.
As we witnessed his death together, the world changed. Across Alabama, folks are struggling with this, seeing injustice and inequality and wanting to see that end. We cannot let this moment pass. The road to racial justice has taken far too long, but it's a journey we must make, and we must make it together.
Tell us about how Doug Jones is campaigning in this race. Obviously, in deep red Alabama, he has to kind of be careful about how he talks about President Trump.
Certainly. And he's mostly talked about economic issues, what he likes to call kitchen table issues. So he's spoken about the need for more economic stimulus because of the coronavirus and the economic turmoil we're in. He's really trying to position himself as someone who can help Alabamians on a day-to-day basis with pocketbook issues. And where you have Tommy Tuberville saying, I'll have President Trump back. Doug Jones' campaign saying, I'll have your back.
Mm-hmm. What are the polls saying about the race?
We don't really have a lot of polling in Alabama, at least public polling. There was one poll that was released last month that showed Tommy Tuberville with a 17-point lead. Jones campaign was very quick to push back and say that's not what their numbers show. Their numbers show a much tighter race. But sort of the conventional wisdom is that Tommy Tuberville, in a deeply conservative state, has the edge. But if there's anyone that can overcome that, it's probably Doug Jones.
Is there a lot of outside money pouring in to try and help Doug Jones or Tommy Tuberville, for that matter?
We've seen some outside money come in, not nearly as much as we saw in that special election in 2017. But these campaigns are still, they have a lot of money on their own. In the last report, Doug Jones had about $8 million on hand. Tuberville had $500,000, and we'll get the latest fundraising report here in a couple weeks to see what things look like just around the corner from Election Day.
What's Jeff Sessions up to now?
He has pretty much disappeared, at least publicly. He did endorse Tuberville, but we've not really heard from him since his loss in the primary.
That is Andrew Yeager, a reporter at WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama. Andrew, thank you.
Good to be with you.
Well, a firefighter has died battling the wildfires in California. Those fires have claimed dozens of lives so far all along the West Coast. Many people are missing. Let's start there with Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English, who's been monitoring how the news is filtering through social media. Hi, Femi.
Hi there, Jeremy.
So those fires have forced so many residents in California, Oregon, and Washington to evacuate their homes. What are you seeing on social media?
A lot of dramatic stories, and not just the pictures of the orange smoke-choked skies, but also a lot of information that is wrong. And authorities are battling this bad information. For instance, Medford Police in Oregon found a story, and they put force in big red letters right across it. And they said, we did not arrest this person for arson. No one affiliated with Antifa or the Proud Boys. Please flag or ignore this post if you see it. Thank you. An actual firefighter jumped on TikTok to say the reason why you're only seeing the fires up to a certain point is not because of some big conspiracy and they're only happening in California. It's because of the data that's being used for different kinds of maps. Another one for the authorities, Jackson County Sheriff's Office Police. Do your part, verify information you hear through official sources, and don't spread rumors. Jeremy, I could do the whole segment with all of the police officers and the sheriff's officers saying, please don't spread these rumors. They are wrong. They are spending almost, it seems, as much time as chasing the rumors as they are trying to put out the fires.
You know, we think about social media as a way to help people get information, more information in times like this. And obviously, it's also used to spread a lot of disinformation. Let's talk about another item here. Earlier this week, celebrities like Kim Kardashian and Katy Perry were among those to freeze their social media accounts for one day. What was the purpose of that? And was it effective?
The whole idea of Stop Hate for Profit campaign is to get big name celebrities to jump off Facebook and Instagram, because what their larger, broader campaign is to do is to try and stop hate speech, try and stop bad information spreading on Facebook and Instagram. And they are holding Facebook's feet to the fire, metaphorically, because they're saying, this is your platform. You should be able to police it, to check it. And the way we're going to try and hit you and impact you is by reducing the revenue you have. Now, basically, Facebook is doing really well this year financially. So this campaign hasn't made an impact in terms of Facebook's bottom line. But there is a bigger issue behind this, is that should our social platforms like Facebook and Instagram be the place where hate speech thrives? That is the point of the campaign.
Femi, actor and comedian Paul Rudd made a PSA video about wearing a face mask. Let's take a listen to that.
My name is Paul, and I'm 6 feet tall almost. And I wear my mask, and it's all I ask that you wear your mask. Please wear your mask. Just wear a mask. Just wear a mask. It's easy. It's simple. Please. It's not hard. People are dying. Hundreds of thousands of people are dying, and it's preventable.
You know, it's interesting to hear an actor like Paul Rudd do that, like feel that he has to be the one to tell people to wear masks. What's going on here?
Sponsored by New York State, so the governor, Andrew Cuomo, asked Paul Rudd to do this. And what they're doing is playing on a couple of things that are really well known if you live on social media a lot. Paul Rudd, social media is obsessed with how young he continues to look. He doesn't seem to age. So making fun of basically Paul, his kind of like dad's age, pretending to be a millennial. So trying to get younger people to laugh them into wearing a mask. So maybe it will have an impact. It's certainly funny. Just look up hashtag wear mask and Paul Rudd and you can see it for yourself.
Femi, I have to tell you about the funniest thing that I saw on social media this
tell
week
me,
because
Jen.
it was really good. It's somebody came up with accordion Trump, and basically yes. because he makes these hand gestures when he talks and he moves his hands out and then in and out and then in, they put an accordion in his hands and then they've put together this video. Take a listen because you can hear it. You can't see it, but yeah. you can hear a little bit right here.
To be honest, I think if he did have something, they would have released it. They would have been glad to release it. I don't want to take advantage of something. I have something that...
So he's just moving his hands in and out as he does it. I mean, it is... We'll post it at here now.
That goes down really well on radio, Jeremy, but I know you're posting.
Femi Oke, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks, Femi.
Take care, Jeremy. You're welcome.
This weekend in Thailand, student demonstrators will again be staging protests against the country's military-backed government. The security forces are also preparing to meet them. Michael Sullivan reports from Bangkok.
Last month's demonstration at Bangkok's Democracy Monument was the protesters' biggest yet as they peacefully pressed forward with their demand for a new government and a new constitution. Police estimates put the crowd at roughly 10,000. Organizers suggested it was twice that and hope for more this weekend. But as their numbers grow and their defiance, the threat of confrontation grows too.
Every day now, going forward, is a worrisome day. The student movement has gathered momentum. They're very passionate. They are very committed. They have nothing to lose now.
That's Titinangpong Sudarak, a political scientist at Bangkok's Chulalongkorn University.
At the same time, the military and monarchy are so entrenched now that, you know, they also cannot make too many concessions, if at all. So it looks to me very combustible, looks almost like some kind of inevitable clash before we can have some kind of resolution.
The Thai military has carried out a dozen successful coups since 1932, often with the tacit approval of the monarchy. A military that has made defending the monarchy one of its core missions. The latest round of demonstrations are the biggest since the military again seized power 6 years ago.
The government and the military are really facing a predicament right now. My hope at the moment is just that violence can be avoided.
Matt Wheeler is senior analyst for Southeast Asia for the International Crisis Group. He says the reason he's worried is the military's history of resorting to violence to silence voices they don't want to hear.
We've seen the military shoot down pro-democracy protesters in Bangkok in 1973, in 1976, in 1992, in 2010. And we've also heard voices on the establishment side suggest that Thailand is ripe for another 6 October 1976 event in which paramilitaries and vigilantes massacred pro-democracy protesters at Thammasat University.
After last month's rally, General-turned-Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha darkly warned those demanding his ouster were creating divisions that could leave the country engulfed in flames. Shortly after, Facebook bowed to pressure from the government and blocked a website critical of the monarchy and the military that had more than 1 million members. 22-year-old Yuttachai Pungsi's son is helping organize security for this weekend's protests, which he worries will be disrupted by royalist agitators.
They can bring many persons to go to Thammasat University to fight with us.
He's especially worried about Sunday, when protest organizers plan to bring their demands to Prime Minister Prayut's office at Government House.
We don't know the different group try to stop out with some violent thing or the weapon. Then the government can take control by their power, or special force or police and military.
He says he hopes it doesn't come to that. So does 21-year-old Sugriya Wanuyawat, a leader of one of the other groups in the Loose Student-Led Alliance. She thinks organizers of this weekend's protests may be pushing things too hard.
I want to see peaceful protests on Saturday and Sunday. I don't want to see that kind of action or anything that show that we are trying to provoke the government.
The government says it will deploy hundreds of police and other security personnel to maintain order over the weekend. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Bangkok.
Well, before we go, we have an update on this hurricane season, which is already one for the record books. There's now a storm named Alpha, and this is just the second time the Greek alphabet has been used for storm names. Megan Borowski is a meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. And Megan, there is so much going on right now. Tell us about Alpha.
Oh, my goodness. So much going on today, Tanya. We had Alpha form just a little while ago off the coast of Portugal. Technically, it is a subtropical storm. It's in the subtropical latitudes and has a little less symmetry than a typical tropical system. And that's expected to move to the northeast and impact Portugal over the next couple of days in Spain. Just heavy rainfall in that area. Also today, we had Tropical Storm Wilfred form in the eastern Atlantic Ocean. That is also expected to track westward through the central Atlantic. Not expected to impact land at all, though.
Yeah, there are several. Where is Sally even in this moment now?
So
we were just talking about Sally a few days ago.
I know, right? It was a hurricane a few days ago. Now we just have the remnants of Sally right now exiting the mid-Atlantic coast, impacting the Delmarva Peninsula with some rainfall. But that'll quickly move offshore in the next couple of hours or so, Tanya.
So much to watch here. Alpha will not be a threat to the U.S., but it is still moving along the north. Megan Borowski is a meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Megan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.